This one for the homemakers. Hey, this one for the homemakers. Hey, hey, dancing through a homemaker. Hey, hey, this one for the homemakers.
Welcome to Patriarchy Country, where we are throwing back the curtain on what life is like when you're a member of the Patriarchal Wives Club. We are talking about a biblical patriarchy here. So this is a patriarchy country where the sandwiches are always made and the women are allowed to have opinions. Today, I am joined by my friend Ash, who I met in Twitter Spaces, and we are going to be talking about data collection, and some of the more disturbing things that she informed me of one time. I'm going to start us off with a verse that she requested I read. So this is going to be Amos 4:13. For behold, he who forms the mountains, who creates the wind and reveals his thoughts to a man, who turns the dawn to darkness and strides on the heights of the earth, the Lord, the God of hosts, is his name. So that's Amos 4:13. Ash, welcome. Welcome. How are you today?
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me. I'm great. And I like that verse, especially in a, you know, kickoff to this topic, because when we talk about data and technology and our kids, and it's real easy to get overwhelmed. And remembering that God is in control, that God is the one who speaks his thoughts into the minds of men, it gives me great comfort as we explore this dystopian topic.
Absolutely. And comfort is something that is needed sometimes, a lot of times, in how tumultuous things are right now. Sometimes I get really overwhelmed with, I don't know, I look around and I'm like, what is going on? So it's always good to remember that ultimately God is in control.
Amen.
So before we get started, the classic patriarchy country question is, tell me a recent king moment that your husband has had.
Oh, my husband is such a king. So we're in a little bit of a transitional period. You and I have talked about this before, but I was in corporate America for 20 years. I was the breadwinner. My husband stayed home with our three sons as they were growing up. And, you know, over the past couple of years, God has really, there's been a lot of changes, a lot of following his leading, to the point where we are now at the point where he is the primary breadwinner. And it's an interesting but really welcome adjustment. And, you know, recently he was promoted. He's been at a new job for about 2 months and has just absolutely crushed it and was promoted. So
praise God.
That one.
That's awesome. We love an accomplished king. All right, y'all. I met Ash in Spaces. This conversation came about because we just were having a very casual conversation about kids and devices and how we kind of handle that. And then she just dropped this whole load of information on me about how video games collect your data based on decisions you make in the game and all, you know, just all kinds of stuff like that. And I was totally blown away and had never really heard anything like that before. And so I was like, okay, we have to do an episode of the podcast about it. So she's going to take us through some of the basics about data, and then we'll get into like the video game stuff a little bit and what we can kind of do about it. But that's pretty much what we're talking about today. And all right, girl, I'm gonna let you go ahead and
So let me give you a little bit of my background and how I became aware of and concerned about this issue. As I mentioned, I was in corporate America, and for the last 5 years of my career, I was a management consultant that focused on large-scale technology transformations. And I was going very deep on cloud technologies and modern emerging technologies. So cloud is the basically, cloud is where all of the data is stored. So over the past 10 years, there's been a cloud transformation revolution where companies, all companies really, have been changing their technology infrastructure to move away from their own data centers where they own the services and all the servers rather and all of the technology to where they lease server capacity from a major technology provider. So AWS, Amazon Web Services has the majority of the market. Microsoft Azure is second and Google Cloud is third. And there are other smaller players, but basically the world's data resides now largely on the servers of those three companies. So as I was learning about this and becoming an expert in the people and business side of cloud transformation, so how workforces evolve in this environment, training new people, reshaping teams, that kind of stuff, I was learning a lot about data. And at the same time, I have three teenage boys. At the time that I became aware of this, I had one teenage boy, and he was, you know, a gamer. He's playing a lot of video games. And as I was thinking about data more broadly and then looking at the actions of my kiddo, I started to get very uncomfortable. And so the reason that I started to get very uncomfortable is that let's talk about data. So what is data? Well, every digital interaction that individuals, businesses, and governments execute, every transaction you have online, every post you make, all of those interactions are comprised of data. All of that data is captured and stored in the digital world with the majority hosted by those cloud service providers, Amazon, Google, and Microsoft. And every day, more and more data is being transferred to those servers. In the cloud, all of the access to that data is controlled through code. So if you're a business that's using cloud, you are your entire infrastructure is pretty much comprised as code. There's actually a term, infrastructure as code, that you can Google and see exactly how this works. And so the other thing to know is that cloud providers, so those three companies, right, AWS, Google, and Microsoft, they have entire business lines that are focused on data recovery. So the data exists, and if they somehow lose access to it, they can probably get it back. So that's an important thing to understand. And there's this concept of what's called data exhaust. And I think it's very useful for this conversation. I'm going to read this. This is from whatis.com, and it's a definition of data exhaust. Data exhaust is the data generated as a byproduct of people's online actions and choices. Data exhaust consists of the various files generated by web browsers and their plugins, such as cookies, log files, temporary internet files, and .sol files, which are also called flash cookies. In its less hidden and more legitimate aspect, such data is useful to improve tracking trends and help websites serve their user bases. And this is really the argument that is used, the answer that is given when you ask, why would a company need to collect so much data? Well, the first answer is they can't avoid it. Their technologies are generating data by use. Log files track everything that you do online. The law, and we'll get into the law in a little bit, but the law covers personally identifiable information, what they can do with stuff that identifies you. But most of the data that is generated in our data exhaust, you're holding the supercomputer in your hand, and think of it like a car, right? There's a stream of exhaust coming off from everything that you're doing. And you're not just your phone, right? When you're on the computer, when you're using smart devices in your house, anytime you're using technology, you're producing data exhaust. And so why would companies need to capture all this data? Well, they can't help it. By the law, they're required to mask it. But also the answer they'll give you is that they use it to make products and services better. They analyze the data and they figure out where, you know, problems are, where user experiences aren't so great or could be improved. And then they make the next version of their product better. And this becomes relevant with the video game example. I'll pause there.
Okay. I'm just thinking, you mentioned cookies. And so pretty much every website I go to, I have to click okay, accept cookie terms.
Yep.
And I would bet, I don't really know what that means. I know I'm supposed to clear it out sometimes. And I know that it involves data collection type stuff. But personally, I just click okay, accept.
Right. And so that's actually a very good example of where the law falls short. because you click accept because you want to use the website, but you don't know what you're accepting. And what you're doing is you're giving your consent, right? That accepting cookies is giving your consent for the company to collect your data. And their terms of service, terms and conditions, you can click on that link and read, you know, the 150 pages of how they're using your data, but nobody does that. In the law right now, we don't have informed consent. We have, in the law in the United States is very fragmented. Most of the strictest data restrictions are by state. California is the strictest in the United States, but there's no national federal law that governs how our data is used. There's a bunch of laws that govern different aspects of how our data is used. But in the European Union, they have a law called the Global Data Protection Regulation, GDPR. And it is a, you know, European Union-wide law that is basically focused on data privacy. It doesn't go far enough, and companies have figured out how to get around it, but at least they have something. In the United States, we don't have anything. And one of the things that we really need to have is informed consent with how our data is used. And that doesn't exist in the States today.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people don't really seem to care that much. I hear people talking about data, about Facebook, and like Meta, how they collect data, or Twitter. And then the last time I remember a ton of conversation about data collection that was in the mainstream conversation was when Pokemon Go came out.
Right.
I remember that was years ago, and people were really like bent out of shape about how it like tracked your location and stuff. But And there was, I think, some deep dives with that. And that's probably the last time that I remember there being this like giant conversation that reached, I wasn't on Twitter at the time. It reached me, you know, just the average like mom. And I haven't heard much about a whole lot about it since, other than like, you know, in regards to social media.
So think about it for a second, right? The Pokemon Go controversy was about how the app that you're using to play Pokemon Go is tracking your geolocation. That is the premise of that controversy. But nowhere did that come up that your Apple iPhone or your Android, your Google Android phone or whatever phone you use has geolocation built in. Find My iPhone is a good example of that. I can not only find my iPhone within feet of where it's sitting, I can find my kids, right? If I've shared my location with them. And so these capabilities exist, and the Pokemon Go controversy raising the subject of geolocation is a great thing, because people need to understand, right? You need to understand when you're holding the supercomputer in your hand that has made your life so much more convenient, you need to understand the trade-off. And the trade-off is that you're generating so much data that it's in effect creating a very robust personal profile of who you are, because it's all of your interactions, it's all of your discussions, it's all of the purchases that you make, it's your banking information, it's all sitting on this device. And so the device has all of that information, and wherever those applications that you're using, wherever their servers reside, that company also has all of your information. And those servers, as I mentioned, is largely three companies. It's Amazon, Google, and Microsoft.
That is, it's overwhelming to think about. So I recently had to buy a new computer, and the computer I had, this one and the one I had before, it came with, you know, relatively small memory. I mean, it's big enough, but mostly they want to encourage you to save everything onto the cloud. And it was like, this is very new. I don't know really how I feel about that, you know, because it's all my lesson plans and everything are just kind of wherever the cloud is. But in so many ways, that unless I'm going to spend $1,000 or $1,500 on a computer to type up my lesson plans, that's pretty much what's available to me. Is that, and so we've kind of been, we're very much being directed into giving everyone all of our data. That is the easiest way to do almost anything.
Well, right, and in this case, right, they've made it so that you feel like you don't have a choice you have, you know, a certain budget that you can buy a laptop. It has a certain amount of capacity. But if you use the cloud, you exponentially expand the amount of data that you can store. Now, in reality, you can get external hard drives pretty cheap and store your data on those. And if you want to understand the impact of, you know, how your data in the cloud can be stored, think about the Hunter Biden laptop. So the Hunter Biden laptop has a certain amount of stuff on it. But where they really, the Marco Polo Group and others have really expanded the insight into Hunter Biden's life is by looking at his iCloud backup and gathering all of the information that's in his iCloud backup. Now, I doubt that you have the same kind of horrifying things on your devices that that Hunter Biden has, but with a weaponized DOJ that views Christians as a threat, that views anybody who wants America First policies and a rejection of globalism a threat, you know, your lesson plans could actually be considered, you know, dangerous information at some point in the future. And so, you know, the understanding, like when you're putting stuff into the cloud, a really good friend of mine, Colonel Sean Smith, retired U.S. Air Force colonel who's been on the front lines of the fight in for election integrity, he calls cloud other people's servers. And I think it's a great, you know, a mindset to understand when you're, you know, whether you're storing your pictures and videos in iCloud or you're storing important financial information or whatever it is, that you're storing your information on other people's servers.
Yeah, so I recorded an episode on how I make my lesson plans, but I haven't released it yet. So the people listening to this may or may not know that what I'm saying is totally true at this when they listen to it. But I go through a lot to make sure that my lesson plans are extremely accurate, especially like my history lesson plans, because my kids come from public school, they come from foster care, and they've been fed a lot of like mainstream narratives about things that are not quite as historically accurate.
So you're saying you know, it's definitely dangerous information.
Right. That's what I was getting at. Like, I 100% believe that some people would label my lesson plans as dangerous. And I think protecting ourselves and our kids, not in like a paranoid way, but in an informed way, is becoming increasingly important for Christian parents, especially in, you know, in states like California, who apparently, thankfully, have the strictest laws we have about this stuff. But California is not the only blue state that's, you know, relatively anti-Christian. So that's, yeah, this is just stuff that we need to talk about more for sure.
Yeah. And, you know, to the point, like, how do we combat this, right? How do we fight against this? Well, the first step is understanding it. And I'm glad we're doing this today, because I think it's really important to understand. We think about technology, we think about the user experience. The majority of people think about technology in terms of their relationship with whatever technology they're using, whether they're, you know, using Microsoft Windows, or they're using, you know, they're on their Apple iPhone and running a specific app. The information that we're using on Twitter, I mean, the Twitter files showed, you know, from a front-end standpoint, from a user experience standpoint, how information can be manipulated. But what people don't really understand is the infrastructure that's underlying these technologies. And the reality is, with technology, there are system log files for pretty much everything. For everything, not pretty much, for everything. There are system log files. Everything that you do online is tracked, because that is how technology is set up. You can't not collect you know, data on people if they're using your technology. That's why we have terms and conditions. It's why there is, you know, a disclosure to accept the cookies, because they're definitely tracking your information. They can't not, because that's how technology works. The law requires masking of personally identifiable information pretty much across the board, right? With HIPAA and the other laws that have been passed, personally identifiable information on technology has to be masked for, because, and it's masked because they can't avoid collecting it, right? You can't design, I mean, I suppose you potentially could, but nobody is designing technology systems that don't collect this type of data on their users. And so the law requires them to mask that data. We've heard of masking in the intelligence scandals that have come out, right? Somebody unmasked General Flynn in an intelligence conversation, but you know, went in surveillance over a foreign target. A U.S. person was captured, and the decision was made to unmask. That was a unilateral decision that was made to unmask General Flynn in that case. But it's important to understand that those decisions are in the hands of pretty much anybody who any technology business. And in 2023, every company is a technology company because everything is online.
Yeah. So I don't know how much we talked about this, about how anti-technology my husband is. But when we got married, he didn't even have a checking account because in his mind, like, if you have a debit card, the government can track what you're buying all the time. And if your money is like in the bank, that then they're just one step closer to being able to take it. And
he's not wrong.
17 years ago, he's not wrong. And 17 years ago when we got married and he went and paid our bills individually at the company in cash, I thought, this man is so old school. Like, this is crazy. And now, like, post January 6th and some of the other things that have gone on, I'm just kind of looking around and I'm like, this man is a genius, like, and way underrated because he was totally not wrong. And so one of the things that, I don't know, it's just kind of made me think of things in our life, but okay, so I had this older version of Microsoft Word from when I was in college. And when I got my last computer, I still had one, you know, you could put it on like three or four computers, and I had one key left. And they took it for a while, and now it's all Microsoft 360. So you have to pay, or you can't use their stuff anymore. And I use Word to type up my lesson plans. My girls use PowerPoint to do a lot of their projects and stuff like that. Well, I was complaining about it to somebody not too long ago, and their answer was just use Google Docs. And I use Google Classroom for, like our pod students and stuff, but it's like, we're all just so casual with everything just like being online. But I've heard stories of Google Docs, like things disappearing. And, you know, I just don't know that I want Google to have everything I ever type, but we're just like so steered that way. And with Tony being so anti-technology, I've just kind of been hyper aware of how increasingly online every part of our life has become.
Oh yeah, for sure. And you know, the reality is that whether you're using Microsoft or Google, you're still using other people's servers, right? And if you're, you know, you can have your kids write on paper and pencil, but in the reality of 2023 is that we use technology. So in my opinion, I use Google Docs. Google Docs from a cloud security standpoint is the strongest in the way that they handle security. That's from external threats, obviously, not from, you know, Google deciding that they're going to mess with my stuff. I haven't had those problems. And they would, you know, if you could prove it, they'd have pretty significant lawsuits on their hands. But the reality is that it is a pinky promise of trust, regardless of which technology provider you're using. That is, you know, if you're using a major technology provider. Now, there's lots of, sleuth type people that have, you know, word processing and other things, Linux operating systems and other technologies that are way more secure and protect your privacy better. But you're basically talking about departing from mainstream technology at that point. We do find ourselves in a difficult position. And again, I think that understanding the nature of the technology, understanding that you are using other people's servers, you're putting your information on other people's servers, and anything that you do online is tracked, that's a very important, you know, kind of core belief to understand, right? It should define your relationship with technology once you understand how the technology operates. And you don't have to become, you know, an infrastructure expert, but basically understanding that, you know, when I write up an article in my Google Docs, you know, my draft is in Google Docs. My draft is sitting on Google servers. When I publish it on Substack, it's, you know, then sitting on whoever is running Substack servers. I don't know for sure, but probably AWS because they're running everything. And understanding that relationship, just the basics of how the technology is, you know, is structured and the companies that are involved. One of the things that drives me crazy about, you know, the fight against big tech, we hear lots of people saber rattling about taking down big tech, but the majority of the time they're talking about censorship, right? Or maybe they're talking about manipulation of your documents in Google Docs, but that's way lesser to the discussion about censorship. Well, censorship is an end user issue, right? It's, I want to say something and these big tech companies aren't letting me say it. The big tech companies benefit greatly by keeping the conversation focused on censorship and not on data privacy and not on how they're using our data, not on how they're analyzing our data or doing predictive analytics on our data, right? This is probably a good time to shift and talk about the video game examples. Does that sound good?
Yeah. I just have a question real quick. Sure. So are you saying that, so I've got Microsoft 360 and then, or Microsoft Office 360, whatever it's called, the Word, PowerPoint, that stuff. So my computer, I do some other things on it too. So it's obviously I had to have it connected to the internet to download that, but then it's not connected to the Wi-Fi. Whenever I type stuff up, it's not connected to the Wi-Fi ever after I download what I need to. And so are you saying that they still would have access to what I'm typing up if I'm storing it on like a removable hard drive, which is what I do?
So use of they, right? Is
I don't know, whoever they is, Microsoft or who, I yeah, honestly
from
I don't
a technology from a technology provider standpoint, yes. Okay. And this is, so there are controls in place and there are policies and procedures and there are security promises that are made by the technology providers that they're not going to manipulate your data. That's all in the terms and conditions.
Yeah.
The reality is if you have bad actors, then they absolutely have access to it. We know this from voting machines, right? Voting machines not connected to the internet, but they all have wireless modems, which means they can be hacked. They can be tunneled into. They don't need to be, you know, connected to the internet in order, you know, and I realize you can't see me. I'm doing scare quotes with connected to the internet. If they have the capability, then yes, the answer is yes.
Okay. Yeah. And just to be clear for anyone listening, I'm not hyper concerned about anyone coming after me with my lesson plans. I really am just trying to understand exactly, you know, where the risks are in general, because a lot of people, they type up their lesson plans on their computer, sure, but they also do a bunch of banking stuff on their computer and it is connected to the Wi-Fi and loading stuff onto the cloud and all of that kind of stuff. So I'm just kind of generally trying to understand, but go ahead. The video game, this was really kind of like both fascinating and scary to me when you told me this, and it was just an aspect of data collection that I had never even, it had never crossed my mind.
Yeah. So I want to just read a couple of, I'm going to read an excerpt from an article that I wrote because this excerpt has quotes in it that I want to read, but the quotes are in context. So I wrote this back in July of 2020, published it in 2021. I didn't publish it in July of 2020 because I just had a paper published, bylined by me on AWS. And I was still in that world and I was terrified to share my concerns at that point, but then eventually I got over it. So this, this quote, I'm gonna start here. Dave Smith explained this eloquently, and this is the dangers of video game data collection in his December 9th, 2013 piece, The Impact of Big Data on Video Gamers, quote, because video games happen in a virtual world, it is possible to measure just about every aspect of the game. It's kind of like being able to observe a sports match or a battle, but being able to attach a telemetry sensor to every player, every weapon, every bullet, every surface of the environment, and gather all of that data in real time. Big data has made this possible, and video game companies routinely gather 50 terabytes of data per day to improve their games, operations, and revenue, end quote. And that 50 terabytes of data per day was back in 2013. So then another quote, there's a guy named Patrick Stafford wrote a piece in May 19 entitled "The Dangers of In-Game Data Collection. Can Your Choices Come Back to Haunt You?" And the quote is, developers see a chart that outlines how that game's players are motivated. How do players interact within a game? What choices do they make? That information can be used to make better games. And it can also be combined with other types of information to build robust personal profiles. Those personal profiles are typically used to target advertising, but privacy experts warn that in the future, that information may be used in sinister ways we can't expect. And then just a couple more quotes to tee up the conversation here. Where is this part? There is a game developer. Here it is. Same piece, that 2019 piece by Stafford. He spoke to a game designer named Sam Barlow. And Sam Barlow said, quote, "I was capturing all this data and then analyzing it later. And it honestly felt like I was spying on someone. It makes you think twice about the information that you're collecting," end quote on that. And then Stafford also spoke to a man named Jay Stanley, who at the time was a senior policy analyst at the American Civil Liberties Union. Stanley said, quote, "Sometimes infrastructure of data collection is built up for one purpose, then people start to think of other uses," end quote. And so it's not Ash saying that, you know, data is the collection is very concerning and that video games in particular are allowing, you know, whoever has this data that's coming off of the video games, which, you know, is again, probably those three companies, certainly in the case of Xbox, it's Microsoft servers that we're talking about. It is the people that develop games. It is the people that work in the data environment who since 2013 have been saying, hey guys, this is really dangerous. Right. So when you think about like let's say my kid is playing Fortnite. He plays a whole bunch of rounds of Fortnite and the game is tracking what his motivations are, what he's doing, you know, what when presented with a binary choice in the game, which choice he makes, which is, you know, indicative of other behaviors in terms of how the game is designed. Everything that he does is collected for every round of the game that he plays. And all of that creates a very robust personal profile of my son and what his motivations and intentions and how he's going to act in certain situations. All of that activity is captured. Now, game developers and people arguing on behalf of the technology providers would say yes, but that data isn't personally identifiable. It's not Ash's son by name that they're looking at. It's who, you know, the player. Sure, that's true. Except that in the case of, you know, I'll just keep going with Microsoft because we're talking about Xbox. The app, the Fortnite game that he's playing is sitting on Microsoft servers. And the Microsoft Live account, which has his name, it was, you know, my name, his address, all of his personally identifiable details are also sitting on Microsoft servers. So again, like I don't have a specific example of where they've combined these two data sets and provided, you know, a deep, robust, intimate, logical profile of my 19-year-old son and his years of video game data usage. I'm just saying that they can do it. They absolutely can do it. And they certainly analyze the data to make, you know, again, with the scare quotes, to make their games better.
Yeah. Okay. So we don't have an example of it happening, but it can happen. That is, I mean, it is concerning to think about the fact that someone could just make this in-depth, like you said, a psychological profile of your child from, you know, his video game data, especially when I think about, you know, some of the games that are out there, like Grand Theft Auto, right, and some of the choices that you're given, like what might they come up with about your child based on whether or not he picks up the hooker or what, right, I don't or know kills that much her. About Grand Theft Auto.
Right. Does he help her or does he kill her? what does that say about him, right? And that's
right.
These are you know, parenting decisions that we might want to understand.
Well, no, for sure.
But
yeah.
For the government, yeah, for the government and for technology companies to be gathering that data and then analyzing it, and you know, they might have stripped his name and personally identifiable information out from the analysis, but they've got his other demographic information, and you can combine that with other demographic information from all of the other players of the same game within the same demographic and start to put those. And they do this, right? This they actually do because it makes the game better. How are 18 to 35 year olds interacting with our game, right? How, what choices can we, you know, what modifications to the game can we make to make our, whatever metrics we're measuring, you know, time on game, you know, however they're measuring the success of the product. They do look at, you know, large swaths of data broken down ostensibly by demographic. Not personally identifiable, but at that point, you have a technology company that thinks they've got a solid psychological view of a certain demographic of kids in the United States. How are they going to use that?
Well, and you can tell me if I'm totally off base here, but when I'm thinking about what you're saying, I'm also thinking about the absolute lack of grace and forgiveness for particularly teenage boys nowadays. I'm thinking of that. I think it was, the kid was from Parkland. He was one of the Parkland shooter. Well, he wasn't the shooter. He was one of the students at Parkland. And there's a group of those kids who have come out anti-gun. I believe this kid, I want to say his name was Kyle, but he came out pro-gun after the school shooting, and his Harvard admission was rescinded after someone leaked texts of him in a group chat, you know, years before the incident actually took place, when he was, you know, 14 or 15 years old, where he used a word he shouldn't have used. And they were like, okay, well, yeah, you can't come to Harvard. And we really kind of hear stories about that all the time. So if, you know, maybe this is not personally identifiable, but are they going to look at this data about, for the record, for anyone listening, my children do not play Grand Theft Auto, but it is, I think, a good example of, because there's so many extreme choices in the game from my point of view, you know, are they going to look at this data of, you know, oh, well, 48% or 64% of, you know, teenage boys decide to kill the hooker in, you know, start to declare teenage boys the next faces of, you know, domestic terrorism or something. I don't, do you know what
yeah,
I mean?
Absolutely. Because absolutely. There's such a, I don't think you're off base at all. I think that so what you have to, you know, forget about the technology for a second. Do we think that the landscape in the United States of America would get to a degree such that the government would want access to that information for, you know, justice system purposes? I think yes. I think we're probably already there. And if they could get their hands on it, they would have already done it. But the reality is there's a piece of legislation, and it was entitled, let me find it here, the Cloud Security Act. Let's see. The Cloud Act, the Cloud Act came out from Microsoft versus the United States. There was a, in Microsoft versus the United States government wanted information of a Microsoft user that was in Ireland. The Microsoft was fighting them because it was a violation of privacy and a violation of their terms and conditions. And what we saw happen was that they changed the law. The lawsuit went away. And the Ireland user's information was provided to the U.S. government. Now, he might have been a very terrible bad guy, and that was a good thing. But the precedent that was set through that, and that was a 2018 piece of legislation, shows absolutely that, you know, if the government can show enough cause, that they can get access to pretty much whatever data they want.
scary.
So it's a question recently, of, do you trust the government enough to, so like your kids are playing, and my kids play video games, right? Like I've, my focus in this space, I think the number one thing that we can do is educate our kids about smart use of technology, help them understand and recognize that everything that they're doing is being tracked. If they're in a group text with friends and they're saying, you know, inappropriate things, that can come back and bite them. That is what our kids need to understand, because our kids are growing up, and you know, I don't know how old you are, but I, you know, grew up analog, and there's, you know, I recognize the difference of this world and the world without technology. Our kids don't. Our kids have been born into a world where technology is all around them. They're super users of technology by the time that they're toddlers. And you know, we need to recognize that that's the point of reference that our kids have. They don't have the before technology point of reference that we have. We need to help them understand that, yeah, these, you know, it's a technology enabled world, and that provides a lot of convenience, and you know, it's made our lives more efficient in a lot of ways. It's, you know, psychologically destroyed our society, I would argue, but you know, we are where we are. But kids need to recognize that technology is a tool, and that tool needs to be used responsibly. That's where I think we as parents can have the most impact. And then when we band together, we can do something like a data bill of rights and actually, you know, try give it a real college try to protect data as an extension of ourselves. Our data is an extension of ourselves. It's, you know, as we talked about with the video game data, these intimate personal profiles about our choices and decisions, this isn't just video games. It's every app you use on your phone. It's how you use your computer. It's the online banking that you do. All of that data exists in the servers of largely three.
Yeah. And so one of my kids is in here, like, listening to my end of this conversation. And when I said what I said about, you know, labeling, you know, whole swaths of teenage boys, you know, domestic terrorists based on video game data, he reminded me that there's like a school district in England that declared that all the boys in the school were all of a sudden very misogynistic, and they blamed Andrew Tate for it. And everyone knows I have my own issues with Andrew Tate, but they're, you know, they're claiming they're having to do these classes where they're having to de-brainwash these boys from all this misogynistic stuff that they've learned from Andrew Tate. And I think we do need to keep in mind that as much as it is in some ways a security for now, that this is not, you know, personally identifiable information, that we are progressively being labeled in groups as opposed to individuals. So, you know, white males, black females, you know, Christians. And so just them having a whole of the, you know, the demographic data, that is a risky thing if they decide to start using it, because they're already using data against demographics of people, just not maybe in quite as an intense way right now. So I thought that was an interesting.
Oh yeah, that's a great example. And you know, what you're describing is the intersectionality, right? Which is the hierarchy of victimhood. And in order to determine who is the greater victim, you have to identify all of the class, you know, you have to put everybody in their classifications by gender, by race, by socioeconomic status, geography, all of that kind of stuff. That's been going on for the past 10 years. They've been boxing us in to our intersectional identities, at which point, you know, we pull the thread a little bit, you can then persecute those intersectional boxes pretty simply because you've identified them all and effectively.
Yeah, most definitely. So, okay, getting back to though, like teaching our kids. So key points of teaching our kids to use responsibly, definitely keep in mind that anything you say or do when you're using technology could potentially come back to you. But what are some other tips that you might have for parents to really, if they wanted to sit down and talk to their kids about using, you know, devices and technology, like, safely, what are your, like, key bullet points for your kids?
So, Yeah. So the first is to understand, as parents, to understand all of the tools that you have at your disposal from a parental control over technology. There mm-hmm. are suites of tools that, you know, even built in to, you know, I use Apple with devices in my home, and my kids have Apple devices. I have every parental control activated on them. They can't add anything new or, you know, they don't have delete rights. They have very limited capabilities with their phones. That also extends to browsers, right? Making sure that you have effective controls on their browsers, on their laptops, any way that your kids are, you know, interacting with technology. Make sure you understand what tools you have as a parent and use them to make sure that you can keep as much tabs on your kids' online activity as you can. The second, as you mentioned, is, you know, make sure that they understand the relationship with technology. There are good examples, like the example that your son gave, you know, the choices that you make, that video game article that I mentioned from 2013, is, can your choices come back to haunt you? In 2023's environment, absolutely, your choices can come back to haunt you. We see that. So use those examples. And, you know, the demonization of kids is a relatively new phenomenon in our public discourse, right? The kid that you mentioned from Parkland, Nicholas Sandman comes to mind, Kyle Rittenhouse. There is we've lost that line where we don't go after kids as a society. That's no longer in effect any longer. And so making sure that you as a parent understand that your kids, when your kids are online, you know, I basically think about it as they're in public, right? That it is the public square. The public square is online now. If your kids are online, they need to understand that anything that they do can be revived and, you know, put on the nightly news or put on TikTok, right? Because nightly news isn't going to resonate with kids. But that, you know, their choices actually have consequences. Kids used to be, you know, kind of sheltered from consequences. It's why, you know, juvenile records are sealed most of the time, because we, you know, gave kids the opportunity to be kids and make mistakes. But that's not a principle of our society any longer. And it's really important for kids to understand that. So that would be the second one. And then, you know, from a parental standpoint, I think it's really important to understand where we are in the landscape of regulation, right? As parents, we're the adults in the room. We are the ones responsible for the self-governance. We have a responsibility and a duty to understand what our government is doing and what they're not doing. And what they're not doing right now is appropriately regulating or auditing or holding accountable technology companies for how they're using our data. So that's not, you know, really a tactic for us to use with our kids, but more a societal priority that we need to get our heads around and start fighting for, you know, data bill of rights, internet, Internet Freedom Act. There's a lot of these movements that are starting to gain ground, understanding that, you know, the issue, and then figuring out what role you can play in solving that issue for society, I think is important.
Yeah. Are there any politicians that are talking about this, like, at all?
Not really. So the discussion largely is centered on censorship and on antitrust and avoiding monopolies of technology. And I think that those are important conversations to have, but it's also a distraction from what I think is the biggest issue, which is how our data is being used. Like I said before, it's the Wild West. And the biggest problem with getting politicians to talk about it is that they don't understand it, right? Politicians are largely in the same boat as regular Americans when it comes to understanding, aside from the user interface where you interact with the technology, understanding how it works. There's a massive education gap in our society. And that's where I feel like it's, you know, it's not just about teaching kids. Kids are going to pick this up way faster than adults, right? Understanding the landscape of technology. Kids are, you know, more malleable in terms of recognizing, you know, things like architecture and infrastructure of technology. And I say that these are conversations that I've had with my kids, my husband, and my parents. And my parents don't understand it at all. My husband, you know, kind of gets there, but, you know, his eyes glaze over. My kids get it right away, pretty much, because they are technology natives, right? Digital natives. And so educating the kids, but we also have to educate the adults. And that includes our local legislators at the state level, because a lot of the data privacy activity is being pushed at the state level right now, but also our federal legislators.
Yeah. And one of the reasons why I thought that this conversation was so important, we talked about before we started recording, is the whole drag queen story hour thing has really shown, it should show everyone that as parents, we hold a lot of sway, because as soon as people really started talking about this stuff, protesting it, there have been quite a few shut down in like Texas. There's the, I think it's called the Texas Family Project. I believe it's like Sarah Gonzalez, and I know Taylor Hansen, who's like an independent journalist, has been involved in a lot of like going to these drag queen story hours or drag queen brunches and showing what's happening on the inside. And when parents start speaking out about this stuff, you know, politicians start paying attention, because these are voters. I mean, there's parents care about their kids, and I think that that crosses any kind of political lines. I've seen a lot of liberals, a lot of leftists even say like, you know, okay, this is actually something I'm going to join hands with the right. And so if we can understand what's going on and start talking about it more, it will force the politicians to start looking into it. They have aides for a reason. They have people who can look into this stuff for them. But we're, as citizens, we're going to have to make them do it. But we have to know what we're talking about first.
Yeah, we have to know what we're talking about. And we also have to recognize when you're trying to change the hearts and minds of politicians, you're trying to change their behavior, you're trying to get them to take up your cause in the legislature, you're battling lobbyists. And in this case, the lobbyists are the technology companies. And they're very powerful, and they have endless buckets of money. And that's why it's important for parents to band together within our communities and start to draw lines in the sand and say, you know, this is about our children. But like you said, we have to understand the issue first, and we have to be able to propose, you know, realistic policy prescriptions for, how to protect our kids. From my view, those include kind of four buckets of things. First is provider protections. We've seen the protections that companies have with Section 230. That's largely focused, the discussion around that is largely focused on censorship, but there's an antitrust component to that. And we need to expand data privacy protections beyond, you know, looking at what California has done, which is California largely mirrors the GDPR legislation in the EU that I mentioned. But we need that, you know, technology crosses state lines, right? Crosses international lines. We need those protections from a national standpoint, and companies need to be held accountable to them. And then we need to strengthen consent laws. We need informed consent, right? So that's kind of from a provider standpoint. In terms of how our data is used, we need consent for every use, clear consent for every type of how they're going to use our data, whether it's aggregated and masked or if it's identifiable. We need to know what we're consenting to when we accept terms and conditions. There is the way that data is used when it's anonymous, when it's, you know, effectively masked, there's a lot of ambiguity in the law. So we need really to clarify the law about how anonymized data can be used. And then we need a regulatory effort around data. There is there's not, right? We have the SEC from a financial, you know, regulating securities from a financial standpoint, but data is the new gold, right? They say data is the new oil. And there's a lot of metaphors for how data is taken from the systems, refined, analyzed, and visualized, you know, as we talked about, those robust personal profiles. Is not just spreadsheets of data. A lot of times those are, you know, visualized, charts of the US or charts of a specific municipality showing the patterns of usage across different demographic groups. There's no regulatory body that exists to look at how data is used. It's again, the Wild West. From a data ownership standpoint, which is my third bucket, we need individual data rights. I think we need a data bill of rights that would include, you know, things that we've already talked about, like protection from censorship, consent for every use. And we need to define those protections, those, you know, the bill of rights, the bill of rights in the Constitution is a set of liberties that define basically what the government cannot do, right? That's how the Bill of Rights is structured. We need that for both the government and from the technology companies, because they are using our data and that's an extension of ourselves. We need to define what they can't do with our data. And so that was the third bucket. And then the fourth bucket is actual audit requirements. I think we need to regulate data like we regulate dollars. We need companies to have independence training, which from an SEC standpoint, that is training about all of the different types of financial conflicts and perceptions of financial conflicts that can take place. That level of training of the regulators and the companies and the people is really important to, you know, very quickly leveling up as a society in our understanding of the issue. So I think we need, I think we need to have a regulatory function with an audit capability. And those are just, you know, some of the, from my background of working for an SEC audit firm for 16 years, and then, you know, working in modern technology for clients for 5 years, those are the things that I think would move the needle in terms of solving the problem. But it's going to take, you know, it's going to take first all of us realizing that there's a problem.
Yeah, absolutely. And we are battling the lobbyists, and we're battling a lot in Washington, D.C., if we're being honest. A lot of influence over our politicians that doesn't include, you know, voter interest, unfortunately. But to be able to take advantage of any of that stuff, they do have to get elected. So, you know, if we really go to our local politicians, especially, but also, you know, your senators, your representatives, you're in the House of Representatives, like they have to get elected before they can take advantage of all this stuff that they potentially are selling out your interest for. And so if we raise enough of a stink about things, hopefully, you know, we can actually get them to pay attention, you know, in a perfect
world. Yeah, no, I think that's true. I mean, it assumes we have free and fair elections, which is a conversation for another day. But
assuming we have
free and fair elections, I think it's true. It's important to recognize that lobbyists are not limited to Washington, D.C., right? I live in Colorado, the capital of the military industrial complex, and a lot of the lobbying of I live just north of El Paso County, which is where Colorado Springs is. It's the only county in the nation that's home to 5 military commands. And all of the major defense contractors have massive campuses and installments there. And the representative for that district that includes that county is, I don't know if he still is, but he was one of the senior ranking members on the House Armed Services Committee, right? So again, recognizing the battle that's ahead. Now the people rose up against that guy in 2022. They had America First people win the assembly, you know, and then the primaries went a different direction. But the recognizing that those lobbyists, they're not just, you know, saying, hey, we want you to do this. They're saying, hey, we want you to do this. And then there's massive financial benefits associated with that in terms of campaign contributions and other favors and things like that. So we have a United States federal government that is incentivized not to solve these problems because the people who benefit from these problems pay them a lot of money.
And that is unfortunately the case with many issues we are facing now. And, you know, for the record, just in this hour that we've been talking, you've mentioned the Hunter Biden laptop, you've mentioned election integrity, And now you have implied that we don't have free and fair elections. We all know that the 2020 election was the most free and fair election that has ever happened in America. So you will be labeled, you probably already are, I'm sure I am. If you're not on a watch list at this point, you're doing
lists.
Something wrong, probably.
Yeah, they actually wrote an article, a local journalist here who I absolutely slammed with an article in rebuttal, and it was a kind of a hilarious exchange. But he wrote an article of the top 10 most dangerous election deniers in the state of Colorado, and I made it at number 5. And
nice.
I was a little bit pissed off because I thought, the 4 and 3, I felt I was definitely more dangerous than they were. I should have been number 3, but is what it is, I guess.
I hate when I get short sold like that.
Right?
I searched myself on Reddit the other day. My friend told me that she does this for herself. So I searched my Twitter handle and I searched my, Twitter name, whatever. And I only found one post. And I was like, I'm so offended, and it was the silliest post of all the things that I post that would make, a lot of people mad. It was just the one post joking about, not hiring a feminist housekeeper for my son and his wife who just had a baby. So I just tell that story to say, I hate when I get shortchanged like that. I'm way more offensive than one Reddit post. Feminist, you need to step it up. I'm just saying. But I hate that for you. You definitely should have been at least number 2.
Yeah, I was having I'm a podcaster and a writer for Badlands Media Group, and we had a group chat going on where one of the creators figured out that he had been put on a whole lot of lists on Twitter. So people can put you on lists, and the only way to get off is to block the person that put you on the list.
Yeah.
And so he's like, here's how you go, right? You go into your list and you go to the top 3 dots at the top and it says list you're on and you go see. And everybody was like, oh my gosh, I'm on this. I was only on like 2 bad lists. And I was like, wait, what the heck?
That's so offensive. It's so offensive.
It is.
Yeah. So is there anything else that you want to share for this just kind of basic conversation, because I definitely would love to have you back to kind of deep dive some of this stuff more, but we have unpacked up quite a bit, I feel like, in this hour so far.
Yeah, no, this has been great. And I think that the number one priority for anybody, especially folks who are brand new to this topic, is to, invest in yourself, become empowered with the information, understand there's a wealth of information to understand the risks of modern technologies. We haven't even gotten into the impact of, AI and machine learning and other modern technologies. We're just basically, we've basically just talked about, the legacy technologies and how they're dangerous from a data collection standpoint. And the other thing is, it's moving so fast. And that's why, the verse that we started the podcast with is so important, because it's very easy to get, kind of blackpilled on this topic and think, well, there's nothing I can do. They're all collecting my information. There's really no hope. Either I become a Luddite and, don't use technology at all, or, I just have to bend over and this is the reality of technology. And the truth is that, you do have power. And certainly when we all become informed and we band together, we can make real change, but we can't make real change until we all are informed and understand the change that we're trying to drive. So that would be, my kind of final thought is to get educated on this topic, recognize the landscape of technology, how technology works, beyond the user interface, beyond you using an app, what's happening with your data in that app when you're using that app. Those are really empowering things to understand. They're scary, and this isn't going to be an easy fight because we've allowed it to get too far as a society, but we do have, as the people, and certainly as parents, we do have a lot of power.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people are looking around and realizing that, we've let it get too far and this is going to be a fight, but we do have power. That's pretty much the position we're in on everything. If you're on the right,
100%.
Is that we've let so much go and we can fix it. I, I can't, honestly, like, I can't stand a black-pilled person. Not, I have a lot of black pillars that I hold dear, but it's like, dude, we can turn this around. Like, we're post-mill eschatologically, so it's like super, that's like the ultimate white pill. It's really hard to black-pill me. But even in the moment, because, you know, post-mill, it's like a long-term plan, we can turn this around. It may take decades. It may take a couple generations, but we can get this back together. You know, this is going to be fixed next week, but we are going to have to buckle down and realize that, like, we got to pump the brakes on a lot of this stuff.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you're 100% right. I agree with you. I think we can change it. I don't think it's going to take generations to change, because I think it's moving so fast that we're reaching a tipping point, but it is going to take us being engaged, and we're definitely not going to win if we don't try. And so that's, you know, that's where I, you know, I can't stand a black-pilled person either, because, you know, when the only option after the black pill is to give up, and I'll never.
Yeah, it's so depressing. When I say, like, it'll take generations, I don't mean this specifically, because you're right, like, technology moves so fast. Like, that's, who knows where we'll be in generations, technologically speaking. But I just a lot of the issues. Oh, goodness. That's a whole other conversation, right? We can have. You know, I heard Michael Malice one time say that, like, he rejects the black pill because it's cowardly. It assumes that the opponent is insurmountable, and they're not.
100% agree with that.
As a Christian, that, like, really, he's not a Christian. For anyone who's listening, who doesn't know, like, Michael Malice is this. He's like an anarcho-capitalist, I believe, and he's written some really interesting books, one about North Korea that was just fascinating, and, you know, very interesting person, but not a Christian, not religious. But it just really, it resonated with me when I read that tweet, because it was like, yeah, I as a Christian, I know that nothing is insurmountable, you know, and so not for God. And so, you know, to be black-pilled, that's just,
yeah. And, you know,
I mean, I just can't.
In this society, I see the hand of God everywhere. I think the only reason that we haven't had a civil war at this point is that the hand of God has been holding people back. God is sovereign, right? I mean, mm-hmm. he's the most high, almighty master of the universe. There's nothing that he can't do. We can't even, you know, fully fathom who God is, but we can recognize him as sovereign, and that's what he asks of us. And once you do that, and you get, you know, right with God and get him in the right position and in oriented with regards to how you go through life, in my experience, you see the hand of God everywhere, because there are so many things that happen that just don't make sense, but for God.
Are you sure you're not a Calvinist? You sound like a Calvinist.
Oh, right, I am now. Definitely not a Calvinist. I don't believe in predestination.
Really? You believe in God's sovereignty, but not predestination?
Yeah, because I believe in free will.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this is also another whole conversation we can have. We're not going to do it right now, but I would love to deep dive that with you, because I don't know if you know this or not, but we definitely are Calvinists. Please go ahead and, like, plug your stuff. If you guys don't follow Ash, you definitely should. When I post the link to the episode, I'll tag her in it on Twitter. But definitely follow her and follow her work. She's really great. She writes a lot of good stuff. And she's got a show on Badlands. It's all good. She's awesome. It's just all good. So plug your...
The best place to find my work is just go to linktree.com/ashinamerica. That's Ash with an E. I do a show on Sundays called Culture of Change, where we break down the globalist agenda that's coming out of the World Economic Forum and the UN and the WHO. And from a change management standpoint, how those changes show up in our daily lives as, you know, regular Americans. So that's on Sundays at 6 p.m. Eastern. We have a show on elections called Why We Vote. That's 5 p.m. Eastern on Tuesdays. I do a show called Raising a Nation Saturday, 9 p.m. Eastern, with Kate Awakening, where we talk about parenting and motherhood and womanhood and really the culture war. And then Monday through Friday at 7 a.m. my time, 9 a.m. Eastern, I do The Brief, which is kind of a quick news show in the mornings. And then I write all over the place for a bunch of different publications. So linktree.com/AshenAmerica is the best place to go.
Awesome. And do you have any last words before I close us out with Tony's disclaimer?
No, thank you so much for having me. I always enjoy talking to you. And I think this is a very important topic. And, you know, like I said, it could be overwhelming and it's kind of easy to throw your hands up, especially if you're, you know, more of an analog person or technology boomer. It's, you know, easy to get overwhelmed and throw your hands up. But, you know, we've got kids that are digital natives and we need to understand the world that they're in.
As a tech boomer, I very much appreciate you, you know, coming here and discussing this stuff, because my husband, who hates technology, he's way better at it than me. So I don't know what's wrong with me, but I'm gonna go ahead and close this out, you guys. Thanks so much for listening. And before we go, I will just remind everyone that all of the thoughts and opinions expressed here belong to the person who spoke them and their husband. But as with everything in patriarchy country, this episode has been husband approved. So you can direct any of your complaints or misgivings straight to the man himself. Tony is at What's Good It's Tea on Twitter, and he joined specifically for this reason. So please feel free to direct any of your ire towards him, and he will promptly remind you that he approved this episode before it was released, and he runs his house as he sees fit. So thank you guys, and until next time.
Okay. That disclaimer is hilarious.
It's so funny.
I love it. That's awesome.
Yeah, but he was. Hey, this one for the homemakers. Hey, this one for the homemakers. Hey, dancing through a homemaker. Hey, this one for the homemakers. 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 Like, yeah.